2 Samuel chapter 18. It's been a hard time for David. He has flown from Jerusalem. I couldn't think of the path. He has fled. Fled, there it is. I was thinking fleed, but that's not the word. He fled from Jerusalem because Absalom was attempting to take over the throne and have David eliminated to eliminate any opposition. And it came down to a battle, which we read about last week. The servants that were following Absalom gathered the armies of Israel, and it says they encamped in the land of Gilead, around where David was at in Mahanaim. So this area up here to the top of your screen is the land of Gilead. It's a big flat plain. For the most part, it's a great place for grazing cattle. That's why several of the tribes of Israel wanted to remain in the land of Gilead when they conquered the land. They said, "Hey, this is a great place for sheep and cows, and let's stay here, and we'll take over all this land, and then we'll help you guys go over and take over the land on the western side of the Jordan River." So Absalom has his troops encamped up here in Gilead. This town right here is Mahanaim, which is where David was managing his army from. So his servants, however many they were, we don't get numbers on either side of this battle, except that we know how many of Absalom's followers get killed in the ensuing battle, and it's 20,000. So it's a very large number of people. But it says that the battle took place through the forest of Ephraim, which is over here. Ephraim is this area. So the battle must have started here in front of Mahanaim and taken place across the Jordan River Valley, which if you can see this dark line here, it's because this is a topographical map and there's a very steep change in elevation from Gilead going down into the Jordan River Valley. You have up here in Gilead, you're somewhere around 100 feet, maybe 3,000 feet, and in just a couple of miles' time, you go down to the Jordan River, which is about 1,000 feet below sea level. So you have several thousand feet of decline in just a short distance. There's very steep cliffs over here. So as the battle raged and the people of Israel fled from before David's men, they fled across the Jordan River Valley trying to get home. And this area must have been covered in a thick forest because that's where Absalom gets his head tangled in the branches of a giant oak tree. Absalom is killed by Joab despite David's orders to let him live. Joab is taking the more normal course of things, which is Absalom deserves to die because of his rebellion. And so that's the course that Joab's taking. However, he does have standing orders from the king not to harm Absalom, if possible. Now, if Absalom had fallen in the course of battle, I'm sure David would have understood that. But Joab took it under his own hand to kill Absalom while he's hanging helplessly in the tree. Let's think about that for just a moment. Does Absalom deserve to die for his crime? Yes, he does. What crimes has he committed? He's trying to kill his own dad, yep, under the Old Testament law. An adult child rebelling that way against a parent is deserving of death. Incidentally, when in Exodus 21 it talks about a child that curses his mother or father, let him die the death, that's not talking about five-year-olds, by the way. That's talking about adult children that their whole life, mom and dad have been attempting to train them and attempting to bring them into submission. But by the time they're adults, it becomes quite clear that despite the best efforts of mom and dad, the children are rebellious and curse their parents. That's the point when they become worthy of death. So we're not talking about putting to death, you know, 6- and 7-year-olds that refuse to clean their room and hold their breath until they pass out. Which is a lot of times critics of the Bible point to things like that and say, "Oh, you believe in a God that believes in child abuse." And say, no, God doesn't believe in child abuse. He does believe in discipline. He does believe in correct training. But that verse is talking about adult children. And so Absalom is guilty of that. He's exactly what Exodus 21 is talking about. What other crimes is he guilty of? Oh, I'm sorry? He did kill his brother, right? He deserves to die for that one. He's committed murder. So he deserves to die. So Joab did the right thing. True or false? False, okay? Why do you say false? Wasn't the means God gave. So what means did God institute for executions? I'm sorry? Government. Yeah, there was a trial that was supposed to happen. Under God's Old Testament economy, there were protections put in place to protect innocent people. Incidentally, our entire system of government is very much modeled on a biblical model. Trial by jury, guess where they got that? That was from the Old Testament, so that you couldn't be convicted of a crime unless there were witnesses, unless there was good proof that you committed it. So the government can't just throw you into jail for anything it wants to. You have to have a trial by jury. That's a biblical principle. All right. So there should have been a trial. Joab is trying to bypass God's justice system, which you couldn't do. And so if Absalom is deserving of death, that should be brought to trial, and then he could be convicted and executed. But that's not something for Joab to take into hand. Now, we've said before, you kill somebody in battle is not the same as murdering, right? People die in war, and that's different. That's not what we call murder. So why isn't this considered a death in a battle? The battle's over. Yeah. And where's Absalom? Hanging helpless in the tree. That you've disarmed your enemy. He's no longer a threat to you. That battle's over. You know, we carry that principle. It's why we have the Geneva Convention, to keep people from doing things like that, right? As soon as they are no longer a threat, no longer able to make war, the fight is over. And you're to treat them as a prisoner of war. So Joab doesn't follow that either. Well, this passage of Scripture that we're looking at now is the aftermath of that. They heap a great pile of stones on top of Absalom, which, by the way, is a sign of a curse. Think of anybody else in the Old Testament they heaped a pile of stones upon? The whole city of Jericho, right? A city that was completely devoted to destruction under God's curse. So what's that? I'm sorry, I still didn't hear you. Judas? They buried him in a tomb, but they had to buy a field for him to do it. But yeah, having stones heaped upon you was not a good sign. It wasn't a sign of an honorable burial. If you wanted to be honorably buried, you were buried in the tombs of your fathers. And Absalom is buried apart from his fathers. So that's a very significant fact that happens at the end of that. So we're in verse 19. The battle's over, and we are over in this area somewhere north of this word Ephraim. This is where that forest would be. So this is where the battle has taken place. All the Israelites have fled and gone to their respective homes, and so the fight is done. Verse 19, then Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said, "Let me run and carry news to the king that the Lord has delivered him from the hand of his enemies." Now remember, Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, was one of the two men that stayed in Jerusalem as a spy, a messenger spy. He's very, very loyal to David. So now that the battle is over, he wants to be the one to carry the news of the victory to David. All right? And so he requests permission from this. But Joab has another idea, and Joab said to him, "You are not to carry news today. You may carry news another day, but today you shall carry no news, because the king's son is dead." All right. He says, "I don't want you to carry news." There's probably a sense here in which Ahimaaz wants to deliver the news in a certain way, and he knows it's not going to quite get delivered that way. If Ahimaaz is loyal to David, and Ahimaaz heard David's order not to hurt Absalom, and Ahimaaz witnessed Joab's cruelty, then he probably wants to get this reported the right way. He wants this news to get back to David of what's actually happened. And so if you allow Joab to select his own press corps to send the news back, how's the news going to get back to David? Oh, news is unbiased, right? They just report the facts, don't they? What is that? Is that Fox News unbiased? I can't think of the rest of their little catchphrase. I don't hardly ever watch it, so anyway. So Ahimaaz wants to make sure that this news gets reported accurately, but Joab is denying him that opportunity. He says, no, you're not going to run today. You can carry news some other time, but not today. Verse 21, then Joab said to the Cushite, and we have no idea who this Cushite is, but Cush was a land over south of Egypt. So if this is a Cushite, he's probably a black man. And he is, for some reason, up in the armies of Israel. He has attached himself to Joab as one of his servants. And he's well-respected enough that Joab is going to choose him for this task. Carrying messages was a hugely important task because we didn't have email, we didn't have Twitter, we didn't have Facebook, so Joab couldn't just say, well, I got to go update my status, just won the battle of Ephraim Forest, Absalom's dead. Yay, God, right? And you can't send messages that way. So if you're going to get message from over here in Ephraim, all the way across the Jordan River, up into Gilead and to Mahanaim, you've got to send somebody. So you want somebody that, number one, can reliably deliver a message. Have you ever given a message to anybody and you found out later that message got garbled? Didn't arrive the way it was supposed to. Sometimes children are guilty of this, right? Say, go tell your brother this. And they get there and the message is nothing like what you sent to them, right? So it happens sometimes. You give somebody a message and if they're not carefully thinking about what you say, maybe in the time it takes them to get from point A to point B, they have summarized it and they change the message a little bit. Well, in these days, you wanted to make sure the message got delivered verbatim. This is one of the things we deal with in how we got our Bibles, is there's a fallacy out there that thinks that every message gets distorted in the delivery. And that's not true. And there's a lot of reasons that go into that, but one of the big reasons is that modern Western man's memory is terrible. We're lousy at remembering things, most of us, because we don't have to. We've got these little devices in our pockets, we pull them out and say, if I want to know something, I just Google it. And say, oh, yeah, what's that recipe for maple syrup? I can't remember it. You know, Google, what's the recipe for maple syrup? Okay, there it is. We don't have to remember because we've got the world's knowledge at our fingertips, so we don't remember. We don't have to remember appointments. We don't have to remember phone numbers. How many of you know the phone number of the friend you call the most? No, you do, I'm sure, but you don't. They're on your speed dial. And again, if you have a smartphone, you just talk to it. Say, call Gary. And it picks up. Call Harry? No, I didn't say call Harry. Call Gary. Call Sherry? No. Call Gary. Call Mary? No. I tried that function on my phone for a little while. And finally, it's so much faster to just scroll through your contact list and tap on their name. But they're working on that. They want us to be able to just talk to our devices and have them work. But I'm getting off topic. Faithfulness of the message. You want it delivered exactly. So, this man was well respected for his ability to deliver this message, but the other thing is, you've got to have somebody that is in tip-top physical shape. How many of you can run a mile? Dan, you can run a mile? Oh, okay. How many of you can run 100 feet? I can go about 30 feet before I decide this is not worth it. I'll just walk casually, right? So, how many of you could run 20 miles? How many of you could run 20 miles over uneven terrain? Because again, as we've looked at the topography here, you have to descend from Ephraim down into the Jordan River Valley. You have to cross the Jordan. Then you have to climb these steep mountains over here, 3,000 feet in elevation to get to Mahanaim. Or Mahanaim. This is not an easy trek, so you need somebody that can cover that distance as quickly as possible. So that's what these runners did, and you kept several of them on hand. This Cushite probably didn't go into the battle. He probably stayed with Joab. So if you need to communicate with the general who's across the battlefield, you send your runner. And he runs across, delivers the message, and then brings a return message. So he's got to be faithful, he's got to have a good memory, and he's got to be in tip-top physical shape. So that's why Joab wants to send this Cushite, because he knows he's a trusted messenger. So Joab said to the Cushite, "Go tell the king what you have seen." Well, that's an open-ended statement. If this Cushite is attached to Joab as one of his servants, then he's loyal to Joab. He's going to present the news in a way that's favorable to Joab, right? But the Cushite bowed before Joab and ran, took off, starts running. And he's heading off toward Mahanaim. It's going to take a while for the news to get there. But Ahimaaz is not done. Then Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok, said again to Joab, "Come what may, let me also run after the Cushite. I still want to go." He's so intent on getting this message to David and delivering it in a way that's hopefully not going to crush David or that's going to deliver the truth about what happened. He says, "Look, just whatever happens, let me go ahead and run too." Now, you didn't normally send two messengers. It was kind of a waste because this guy, by the time he gets where he's going, is going to be spent. There are stories in antiquity of a messenger who ran the whole distance, got there, delivered his message, and died on the spot. Because you're just pushing yourself until your heart and your lungs give out, right? That's why I don't run. I don't want my heart to die, right? Yeah, that's why. So, "Come what may, let me also run after the Cushite." And Joab said, "Why will you run, my son, seeing that you will have no reward for the news?" Now, he calls him my son, not because he's actually his son. This is the son of Zadok the priest. But we've got to remember that Joab is related to David, and David is now in his, well, let's see, he was, now David is now somewhere around 65 years old at this point, early to mid-60s. Joab's probably right around there, too. So Joab is no longer the 30-year-old military soldier that he used to be, all right? Ahimaaz is a very young man. He's the son of the priest. He's not functioning as a priest yet, and so he might not even be 30 years old. 30 years old was when they started into the priesthood. So he's probably younger than 30 years old. But Joab tells him, "Say, why do you want to bother running?" And look at what he says there. "Why will you run, my son, seeing that you will have no reward for the news?" Because the runner would typically get paid. When you got there and delivered the message, the person that received the message would give you a tip. And if it was a really favorable message, if it made the person really happy, then you could get a good tip. Now, you got to run and tell King David that his son is dead. You might not expect anything. But especially since there's already a messenger ahead of you who's going to get there first, you're not going to get anything for doing this. So Joab is basically saying, "Why do you want to do this? You'd be working for free. You're going to run all that distance and not get anything for it?" But Ahimaaz is adamant. Verse 23, "Come what may," he said, "I will run." So Joab said to him, "Run, fine, go ahead. Do whatever you want. You want to run all that distance? Be my guest." Then Ahimaaz ran by the way of the plain and outran the Cushite. Since we don't have a lot of details about where the battle took place other than that it's in this area here, we can only guess that there was a road that connected the two areas and that the Cushite was taking the road. Ahimaaz, however, goes all terrain and just charges down the hills, takes the straightest path between here and there, trying to make it, and he does. Somehow, he gets there before the Cushite does. Not by much, as we're going to see, but he's there ahead of the Cushite. And so he must have really been booking it to get there. What was some of the top speeds there in Olympics of those people running? I forget, but ridiculously fast. Yeah, now, we understand, too, you can't keep up top speed for a marathon race. And you watch the marathoners, and they pace themselves, and they're just going at a decent clip. But they're not going as fast as the sprinters are, all right? Because you can't sprint for 30 miles. But Ahimaaz gets there first. Verse 24, "Now David was sitting between the two gates." A little explanation in order here, because if you have a city and it's surrounded by walls, the gates would be these much larger structures. So you have the wall that was often 10 or 12 feet thick, filled with sand, and sometimes there were little rooms. I got to back up. That sun's like right in my eyeball. All right. The walls often would have rooms built into them, but they were very thick, sturdy walls to keep out invaders. The gatehouses would be even bigger, thicker. And you wouldn't have one gate, you'd have two gates. So you'd have a gate on the outside, and you'd come into that gate, and there would be a room there with some rooms off to the side, probably some stairs going up to the top of the gatehouse and the top of the wall, and then you'd have another gate. And they would have doors on them, and if you picture medieval castles, the portcullis coming down, that's where they would have the portcullis, was in this gatehouse. So there would be two of them. David had sat at this gate when he sent all his men out at the beginning of the battle. They paraded past him as he sat there in the gate. It was a cool place. You're shaded from the sun. It was the place where the judges of the city sat, and so it was a place of honor. And that's where David is. And now he's been waiting there this whole time, waiting for news to come back about the battle. Okay. So he's sitting between the two gates in the shaded area under the gatehouse. And the watchman went up to the roof of the gate by the wall. So he goes out of the gatehouse, climbs the stairs up the wall. He's on top of the wall and he's looking out across the terrain. And when he lifted up his eyes and looked, he saw a man running alone. And, the watchman called out to the king. So you can imagine him standing up on top of the gate, and he yells down into the gatehouse, "Hey, King David, there's somebody running." The watchman called out and told the king, "There's somebody running toward us." And so the king, talking to all the people who are around him, down in there in the gatehouse, would say, "Oh, if he's alone, there's news in his mouth." Now, how would you know that just because he's alone? Well, what's that? Yeah, that's the way it was done. One guy running means there's news. He's a messenger coming at you. What if there's a bunch of them running? The battle didn't go well, did it? Yeah. So if it's just one guy, that's a messenger. If it's a whole group of guys, then you lost the battle and you know something before he even gets there. And so, yeah, if he's alone, there's news in his mouth. And he drew nearer and nearer. So the man is standing on top of the wall, which of course gives you a good vantage point. And he's watching this guy run across the valley. And he's just snaking his way up the hills and coming across the terrain towards the city. And he drew nearer and nearer. Verse 26, the watchman saw another man running. And the watchman called to the gate and said, "See, another man running alone." He's calling down under the gate, okay? He's got to scream because so people can hear him. And he's announcing, "There's another guy coming here." And the king said, "Oh, he also brings news." How do you know that? He's alone. Yep, he's by himself. And the watchman has another idea. Verse 27, the watchman said, "I think the running of the first is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok." So watching these guys run as often as you would, if they were delivering messages frequently, you'd get to know the gait of somebody. You ever recognize somebody? Or sometimes you watch a father walk, and then you watch their son walk and say, "Wow, is that similar? That guy's got the same gait his dad does." All right? I don't know what it is, just a product of the genetics of your build and your muscle and bone structure and all that, but you walk the same way. And so you can get to learn somebody by how they walk or how they run. And so this watchman has seen Ahimaaz enough that he's able to recognize and said, "Well, that looks an awful lot like Ahimaaz." Now, don't ask me what that would be. I'm not sure. Maybe Ahimaaz had a very long stride, or maybe he was just very peppy as he ran, I don't know. But whatever it is, he recognizes it. So I think the running of the first is like the running of Ahimaaz, the son of Zadok. And the king said, "Oh, he's a good man and comes with good news." Because they also had men that they would send for certain purposes. Say, if it's good news, I'm going to send Eldon. If it's bad news, I'm going to send Dan. I'm just picking on you out of the blue there, guys. No comment on character there. But that way, they see Eldon running away off, and I automatically know something about the message, right? So I can communicate the message from a distance, even without Eldon having to get there. Oh, it's Eldon coming. Well, that's good news. I bet the battle probably is going well. I see Dan running at me, and I say, "Oh, we lost, didn't we?" Right? And then I wait for Dan to come and actually deliver the message, but it helps you know something ahead of time. So the king says, oh, it's Ahimaaz. He's a good man and comes with good news. Except, what kind of news is coming? It's not good news. It's bad news. I mean, it's kind of good news. It's kind of bad news. You win the battle. You lost your son. Which way do you go? Verse 28, then Ahimaaz cried out to the king. How he's able to even speak at this point, I'm not sure. Because after running all that distance, I'm sure he just must be in much better shape than I am. But he's run all this way, he gets to King David, and he calls out to him as he's approaching, all is well! And he bowed before the king with his face to the earth and said, blessed be the Lord your God who has delivered up the men who raised their hand against my lord the king. So he's going to form the message this way, God be praised. And who's he mention? Who's that? He doesn't say Absalom, though, does he? Blessed be the Lord your God, who has delivered up the men. So he's going to mention the soldiers. Say, David, you won the battle. He won the battle. All the men who raised their hand against my lord the king, God has saved you from them. But he doesn't mention Absalom. Now, Ahimaaz is loyal to David. We already know that. So why do you think he doesn't tell him? Keep the focus on what's important? Yeah. Could be. Well, obviously it's on David's mind. Look at verse 29. The king said, is it well with the young man Absalom? We're starting to see a little bit of a problem here in David's thinking. You just sent all these men out to battle. And I understand you're a dad. But the news comes back, you won the battle. And your first comment to your messenger is, now what about Absalom? All right, there's no response there to all those men who just put their lives at risk for your sake. So we can sort of understand from the standpoint of fathers, you'd be intimately concerned about the welfare of your son. But it's going to start to become a problem. And we'll see that here as the narrative continues. So, is it well with the young man Absalom? You can see David, just the intensity on his face as he's questioning about his son. And Ahimaaz answered, when Joab sent the king's servant, your servant, I saw a great commotion, but I do not know what it was. Now, Ahimaaz here is referencing two people. When he says, when Joab sent the servant, or the king's servant, he then says, and your servant. The ESV doesn't put an and there, but there is supposed to be an and there. I think the others, King James puts it there, the NASB puts the and there. There is an and in the original, in the Hebrew. And so when he says, when Joab sent the king's servant and your servant, he's speaking of two separate people. So he can probably point behind him and say, when Joab sent the king's servant back there, the Cushite meaning, and your servant, which is a reference to himself, he says, I saw a great commotion, but I do not know what it was. He said, hey, Ahimaaz, what are you doing? Why doesn't he want to tell David what happened? Does he know what happened? Yeah, he was standing there watching it. So he knows what happened, but either he doesn't have the heart to tell David about Absalom, or he, like Kim said, he wants to try and keep the focus on what's right, but he doesn't really deliver the truth here. But it's going to come out. The king said, turn aside and stand here. So he turned aside and stood still, probably grateful for a chance to just stand there and not move for a little while, right? Get a break after all that running. And behold, the Cushite came, and the Cushite said, good news for my lord the king, for the Lord has delivered you this day from the hand of all who rise up against you. Pretty much the same message. You've won the day. The battle's over, and you are king. All of those who rose up their hand against you are gone. He's delivered you from their hand. But he's got the same question for the Cushite that he had for Ahimaaz. The king said to the Cushite, is it well with the young man Absalom? And again, you picture David standing there. He's just, okay, yeah, get on with your message. What about Absalom? What happened to Absalom? That's what David's concerned about. That's his primary care. What happened to my son? And the Cushite answered, may the enemies of my lord the king and all who rise up against you for evil be like that young man. Meaning, he's dead. He's dead. Not only is he dead, but he died under the judging hand of God, and it's a good thing he's gone. So put yourself in a dad's place. Somebody comes to you, says, yes, your son just died, and praise the Lord, it was God's judgment upon him. How would that make you feel? Probably not so hot, right? Well, it doesn't affect David any differently than it affects us. And the king was deeply moved and went up to the chamber over the gate and wept. So he goes up the gate to the upstairs where there would have been a chamber. So the watchman is up even higher, right? And there's a couple of stories in this gatehouse. And so David goes into one of the chambers and he wept. And he wept loudly and he said, oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, would that I had died instead of you, O Absalom, my son, my son. So what do you think the effect is upon all the people hearing him? This is a tough thing for us to sort through. Because again, we can understand as fathers, parents even, how you would handle this, knowing that your son died and knowing that he did die under the judgment of God. This was not an accident. In fact, we were told back in chapter 17 that God was bringing all this to pass because he wanted to bring harm upon Absalom. So as a man like David, who knows God's word so thoroughly, he knows Absalom deserves this. But all throughout his life, David has been incapable of bringing the right kind of discipline to Absalom. Probably didn't do it when he was a young man, when he should have done it. And then certainly, when Absalom did something worthy of death, like killing his brother Amnon, he couldn't act justice against him as the king. And instead, he exiled him for a while, and Absalom went to his grandfather's house in Geshur. But then David welcomed him back. And so I think part of the grief that David's experiencing here is knowing that Absalom died under the judgment of God. That's not a good sign, is it? David had another son that died, born to him from the adulterous union with Bathsheba. How did he respond when that baby died? I'll go to see him, but he won't come to me. Right? So in that point, David's confident that this young baby, incapable of knowing right from wrong and being accountable for its decisions, cradled in the merciful arms of God, David's going to see him again. But not in this lifetime. Absalom dies under the judgment of God, fully responsible for his own decisions. Where does that leave Absalom? Probably not at a place where David is going to see him again. Not under joyful circumstances, right? And so David's grieving here because of how his son died in rebellion against God and against God's anointed king. And that grief is overwhelming him. And even says, I wish that I had died instead of you. But so we can understand David's standpoint as parents. But as the king, the effect that this is having upon his people is deadly. Well, if you wanted to die instead of Absalom, then what did we just go out to war for? We could have let Absalom come here and he could have attacked the city and yet could have happened, but he didn't. David also, I think, is saying there, if I had died, I know that even though I'm a sinner, I know I'm right with the Lord. And so, if I had died instead of you, that would at least leave you with the opportunity to repent. But that opportunity's over. Your decision's been made. And so he's pouring out his grief here in this gatehouse. And the message gets back to Joab. So some time is elapsing here as the army of David starts funneling its way back towards Mahanaim after the battle. We've got several hours passing here as they all gather together from across the country and start marching back toward the city. It was told Joab, "Behold, the king is weeping and mourning for Absalom." And this is apparently also not just a normal sense of weeping and mourning, but this is pretty severe. He's mourning and weeping so vehemently, verse 2, that the victory that day was turned into mourning for all the people. For the people heard that day, the king is grieving for his son. We just saved your life. And all you can think about is Absalom. We just restored the kingdom to you. And the only concern you have is for Absalom? We just went out and risked all of our lives, all of your loyal servants, and the only life you're concerned about is Absalom? Again, we can understand as parents, but this is not how a king acts. A king has to think about his people as well. And as they're starting to slowly filter back into the city, we have this comment that the people stole into the city that day as people steal in who are ashamed when they flee in battle. So here they are, victorious over their enemies. God has delivered David and the nation from a usurper, which would put the nation in a very bad position. They've been victorious in battle, and now they're coming back to the city, and where there should be rejoicing, where there should be celebration, where there should be the king sitting at the gate welcoming his victorious army back with his approving looks and his thanks, he's up in the upper room, crying, weeping, wailing, and everybody that's coming up to the city feels like they have to creep in as if they had lost, ashamed that they actually won the battle. So you can imagine how this is affecting the hearts of the people. Would that instill more loyalty to David, or would that turn you away from him? Oh, turn you away from him. And say, "What? Why is this king acting like this? Doesn't he know what he's supposed to be doing as the king?" And his hold on the nation is already weakened because of this whole ordeal with Absalom. Most of the nation followed his son. And so now as he's going to try to reestablish himself as the king, he's weakening that possibility with this behavior. And the king covered his face, and the king cried with a loud voice, "Oh, my son Absalom, oh, Absalom, my son, my son." Well, Joab finally gets back to the city. So this has been going on for hours. This has been going on for a long time. And he's stealing away this victory from his people. And Joab came into the house of the king and said, "You have today covered with shame the faces of all your servants who have this day saved your life and the lives of your sons and your daughters and the lives of your wives and your concubines because you love those who hate you and hate those who love you. For you have made it clear today that commanders and servants are nothing to you. For today I know that if Absalom were alive and all of us were dead, then you would be pleased." Joab, right or wrong? Oh, he's absolutely right. But you've got to comment on the hypocrisy of it. Why is David so upset? Because Joab disobeyed his order and murdered his son. And now Joab has the audacity to march into this room and rebuke David for his mourning. So Joab might be right in what he says, and he is. David's treating all of his loyal subjects as if they were enemies because they were part of the battle that killed his son. And he's treating all of the rebellious usurpers that were under Absalom as if they were beloved people because he's mourning for them so badly. So Joab is absolutely right in what he says, but Joab, where do you get the gall to come in here and tell David this? You're the one that killed his son. And after one of David's soldiers tried to protect him. That's going to come back on Joab, actually, in a little while. "Now, therefore," here's Joab's advice, "Now, therefore, arise, go out and speak kindly to your servants. For I swear by the Lord, if you do not go, not a man will stay with you this night, and this will be worse for you than all the evil that has come upon you from your youth until now." So Joab, assessing the attitude of the army toward him, says, "David, you better get out there and show them some thanks. Show them some approval for what they've done, or they're not going to stick with you till morning. Your hold on this nation and the hearts of the people is hanging by a thread right now because of this. So under normal circumstances, the son of a king dies. This mourning would be right and it would be proper. But David, the extreme circumstances you're in, you need to weigh this carefully. Absalom's gone. There's nothing you can do about that now. It's over. But you've got to hold these people. You've got to hold the hearts of the people of Israel, so you'd better get out there. Well, the king recognizes the utility of the device, of the advice. Then the king arose and took his seat in the gate, and the people were all told, "Behold, the king is sitting in the gate," and all the people came before the king. So the picture there, he goes back to the gate, he's dried his eyes, he's washed his face, he's no longer in mourning, and he goes down to show some approval to all of the soldiers and the people that took part in the battle, and probably to bestow some kingly gifts upon them. Anytime a king won a major battle, part of the thanksgiving to the troops would be to bestow presents upon them for their work in the battle, right? And so there's David. As we called this section good grief. It's not so good, even though it's grief. He almost lost the kingdom twice. Had to be rebuked by a very unrighteous man. But he's been saved, and the Lord has delivered him out of the hands of his enemy. And unfortunately, this time, that enemy was his own son. Following chapter there, we'll continue on in a couple of weeks, since next week we won't have our Sunday evening service. We'll have our hymn sing after the potluck dinner. Any questions about anything we've